everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. So, taking a little bit of a different direction today, I haven't done a long form Q&A in quite a while, actually. I've been very fortunate with some awesome guests recently, and today's episode is going to be Q&A based. So, I actually don't know, am I going to do this all in one, or am I going to potentially break it into two episodes, because I put up on my Instagram the question feature for those of you on my Instagram, Brian_Keen_Fitness. I do a daily 10 question Q&A, so you can pop your questions in there, anything I can help with. And Monday to Friday, I answer 10 questions every day, Monday to Friday, obviously. And I put up doing a podcast Q&A today. So I got a massive amount of questions. So I have a load of them in front of me here, and I'm going to pick some at random, because they're all over in terms of, some of them are mindset based, some of them are fitness based, some of them are diet based. So I think I'm going to try, and if I keep this all in one episode, I'm going to answer the fitness and diet related first, and then go into the kind of mindset lifestyle related questions later. So as always, on all of my Q&As, if there's any particular questions that you want to jump straight to, you can look in the description on iTunes, on Spotify, on the website, brankeyfitness.com, on Stitcher, wherever it is that you listen. I have timestamped all the questions. So if there's one that wants to jump, that jumps out particularly to you, you can jump straight to that part of the podcast, or you can listen to it in its entirety. But I'm going to keep it kind of fitness based at the beginning, kind of fitness mindset, very like my book, my first book, Fitness Mindset, where the first half of the book's all fitness, second half's all mindset. So I'm going to keep that kind of layout for today's podcast. So the questions all came in from Instagram, so a massive thank you for those of you who sent them in. Apologies for the ones that I didn't get to. There was a ridiculous amount of questions, so it's something I may do again, because I love these Q&As as well. So I'll jump straight in to question number one. So first question, can protein powder make you gain weight or bloat if you're not working out regularly? So this is actually two questions, because can protein powder make you gain weight and can protein powder make you bloat are two very different questions. The answer to both effectively is yes and no to a degree, particularly the first one. So I'll break this up into two parts. Can protein powder make you gain weight? Yes. Protein powder, any calories or any food that is putting you into a surplus, meaning that you're eating too many calories, consuming too many calories, and you're not burning them off, can potentially make you gain weight, or particularly body fat. So gaining weight and adding body fat are two different things. Gaining weight is increasing numbers on a scale. Increasing body fat is increasing the amount of fat in your body. Protein powder can make you gain weight, can make you increase body fat if it's too many calories. So if you're not working out regularly, or you're not burning off it, you can add weight or gain body fat as a result of too many calories. And that's actually one of the reasons that I have a little bit of a pet peeve with like protein bars, protein cereals, fucking horseshit fortified with protein, and every crappy ingredient food that you see, because protein is really, really good for your body. Like, it's the building blocks of everything, you know, in human cells, amino acids particularly, you know, that are make the makeup of protein. But the where you get your protein from is very, very different. You know, protein from a soy protein isolate is very different from something like hemp protein, which is very different from something like a piece of chicken that you eat or a piece of steak that you eat. The amino acid profile is different and the quality is different. Not necessarily one's being better or worse than the other. I tend to personally lean towards real food as much as possible, and they tend to be higher quality foods just because they haven't been tampered with effectively. You know, if you think about it quite logically from a evolutionary standpoint and even a paleolithic standpoint, you're not really designed, or you're not as designed to eat the foods that have been fortified with protein as the ones that naturally have them occurring. So that's one of the reasons that I tend to skew more towards whole foods, fruits, vegetables, lean meats, fish, etc. Assuming you're not following a vegan diet or a vegan protocol, that tends to be my personal preference. But any food can make you gain weight, and any macronutrient, protein included, can make you gain weight. The reason that protein tends to be a little bit better in the sense of compared to, say, carbohydrate, is that they're the same kilocalories per gram. So 1 gram of carbohydrate is 4 kilocalories, 1 gram of protein is 4 kilocalories. And the reason that protein can be more effective in like a weight loss strategy or someone trying to improve the recovery or someone trying to lose body fat is, one, the satiation is better, meaning that the protein, high protein food is going to keep you fuller. It's going to make you feel more satiated. So if you eat a 300 calories worth of chicken, you're going to feel fuller than if you ate 300 calories worth of rice. And that's the same exact kilocalories per gram if you're going pure 1 gram of carbohydrate and 1 gram of protein being equal to 4 kilocalories. So that's one of the reasons why protein can work quite well. On top of it, you know, improving satiation, it also improves recovery. As I said, the building blocks of everything in your body is from amino acids. So you're going to feel significantly better. So that's why protein works really well. Protein powder then is just a method of consuming protein from a food. I think of protein powder closer to a food than a supplement. That's one of the only ones that I'm like, I always think of whey protein and protein powders as a closer ingredient to a food, because for the most part, they're just good quality protein foods. And whey protein in particular, because of its high naturally occurring branched chain amino acids and good amino acid profile, and its ability to be fastly absorbed by the muscle post-workout, means you're going to flood your body with amino acids directly after training, which can further enhance recovery. And the better recovery you have, if you are working out, it means that your workout tomorrow is going to be better, and as a result, the following day will be better again. And you're going to get this compound effect of good workouts, good recovery, burning more calories, building more muscle, lean muscle tissue, which elevates your metabolism. Or if you're doing cardio, you can go harder and increase your heart rate more, which means you'll burn more calories during the workout and have this positive compound effect over time. But too much protein powder can definitely make you gain weight if it's putting you into a calorie surplus. Bloating then, on the other hand, is a lot more common. One of the reasons that whey protein, particularly whey protein, dairy-based proteins, tend to not work very well with a lot of people is there's a high proportion of people in the Western world who are lactose intolerant. If you have no problem with lactose and no problem with dairy, then this is kind of a moot point. It doesn't affect you at all. But if you're someone that doesn't do that well with dairy, doesn't do that well with lactose, then having a whey protein powder that doesn't have a lactase enzyme, which is the enzyme that breaks down lactose that we stop producing as we get older, and most people, you know, in their 20s, 30s, have stopped producing that lactase enzyme, so we need to take it in a supplementary form, meaning that if the supplement company hasn't added lactase into their protein, you need to take it separately. One of the reasons that brands like Optimum Nutrition jump straight to mind, that they've got lactase in their protein. So people even with lactose intolerance tend to tolerate whey protein. I think their gold standard whey in particular, they tend to tolerate that quite well. And there's lots of other companies that do the same. So can it make you bloat? Yeah, 100%. And it's really, really common. My advice with anyone, if your protein powder is making you bloat, stop taking it. So on top of the distress and the uncomfortable feeling that comes with that, it's also going to negatively affect the absorption of other foods that you're eating around that time. Because if your body's bloated, it's not in a prime state to absorb all the nutrients from the food you're eating. So you don't want to have any displacing effect on vitamins and minerals either. You don't want the bloating to negatively affect the absorption of the other foods that you're eating, because the foods that you eat and digest are what are going to give you energy. They're going to what are going to determine your recovery. And if you're not absorbing the food that you're eating, i.e. it's bloating you, then you're not getting the benefit from those foods. And if your whey protein is doing that, I would advise cutting it. The beauty of 2019 is there's so many good protein powders out there. Experiment with yourself what works best for you. If you don't tolerate whey protein, if you don't like the sweeteners that are added to certain whey proteins, look into rice protein, hemp protein, soy protein. There's so many variables. I personally use the Sun Warrior rice protein, even though it tastes like fucking chalk. I still use it because it's fermented, it's sprouted, and absorbs really, really well. I think they changed the formula recently though, because it tastes like fucking dick now. I should have used a different comparison. I said that once on my Instagram story, and they were like, "What the fuck do you know what dick tastes like?" I'm like, I don't know what shit tastes like either, but people are always like, "Tastes like shit." I'm like, it's just an expression. My friend said it to me once and I stole it from him. So yeah, so at this day and age, your protein, you shouldn't, fucking completely digress. It has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. Anyways, your protein powder shouldn't taste poor is kind of what the take home message of that. In 2019, if you're taking a protein powder that you don't enjoy the taste of, you need to experiment with another one. The best protein powder you can get is one that fits into your budget, that doesn't bloat or swell your stomach, and you enjoy the taste of. If you can tick off those three things, that's the best protein powder from you. So play around with brands, play around with sources and types of protein, but if you hit all of those three triggers, that's how I would select your protein powder going forward. Next question. Are your HIIT workouts on Instagram better than traditional hypertrophy or hypertrophy workouts? So I'm going to expand on this because this came in several different variations about the workouts that I put on my Instagram stories. So if you're following my Instagram, I post most of my personal workouts on my Instagram, which are a mixture of, a lot of them are HIIT-based workouts just because that's the way I personally like to train. And it's also the training system that kind of lines in with my goals at the minute, because hypertrophy isn't my goal. Adding size is as far from my goal as possible. If anything, I'm trying to... Jesus, I don't know if you can hear the wind in the background. It's fucking stormy today. Anyways, trying to build size is very, very far from my goals at the minute, because I'm in a fortunate position that I do add size very, very easily. And actually trying to reduce my muscle mass can be quite difficult. I have to really ramp up my cardio and reduce my calories in order to eat into some of my muscle that I have, which is a good problem, I'm aware. It also comes down from levels of muscle maturity. You know, I'm 17 years, nearly 18 years lifting weights, and there's muscle maturity built up there, so you don't lose that overnight. And so my HIIT workouts are very much based around my specific goals. What I would advise is, the reason I put my HIIT workouts up on my Instagram wall, for a couple of reasons. One is for the people, because of the way my programs work, particularly my BKF online program, which is my main body composition program. I've got two programs, my GA Lean Body program, which is for GEA players, and then my BKF online program, which is for people looking to lose body fat, add muscle, etc. And that program isn't open all year. The next one is in September, 7th or 8th of September, the next one starts. And the reason that program's not open all year is just my schedule doesn't allow it to be open all year. So I post my workouts on my Instagram wall to kind of tie people over, for the people that want to work with me or considering working with me. It ties them over. And for the people that can't work with me for whatever reason, financial reasons, time commitment reasons, for whatever reason, there's workouts there that people can do. So that's literally why I post them up on Instagram. And they're also the workouts I'm doing. So it's really easy to capture that while I'm in the gym. In terms of traditional hypertrophy workouts, what I would always advise is base your workouts off whatever your end goal is. So if your main goal is to lose a little bit of body fat, get leaner, keep your functional movement, then my HIIT workouts are going to be perfect for that, because that's literally what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to keep my physique lean, I'm trying to keep my body fat low, and I'm trying to keep my fitness levels high, so that when it transfers over to things like ultramarathons, I'm not losing my aerobic fitness because I'm doing a lot of high intensity work with my gym based work. So kettlebells, battle ropes, dumbbells, barbells, etc. If traditional hypertrophy and trying to build lean muscle tissue and actually trying to build muscle is your specific goal, then you're probably going to be better with a traditional hypertrophy style workout. So always base your goal off whatever it is you're trying to achieve. People that are trying to lose body fat can also lose body fat and change composition with a traditional hypertrophy style workout. It always depends on whatever the end goal is. So for example, in my BKF online program, there's a combination. I have a combination of traditional style hypertrophy, just because it changes the composition of body shapes for people. You know, guys trying to build lean muscle tissue, girls trying to build their bum, trying to get more definition in their shoulders, trying to lower their body fat, etc. But I mix it with HIIT style workouts and finishers. On week 3 and week 6 of my program, I actually add in all finishers for the advanced trainers. And so it depends. It always depends on the goal. So it's not a case that my HIIT workouts are better or worse than a traditional hypertrophy workout. It depends on whatever your end goal is. So what I would advise is, if you're trying to build just pure muscle, a HIIT workout probably doesn't lend to that as well as somebody that's just trying to get leaner, lose a little bit of body fat, and improve their fitness. So hopefully that answers your question, and that at the end of the day, any training program, CrossFit, hypertrophy, HIIT workouts, strongman training, marathon running, triathlon training, it all depends on your end goal. What is it that you're trying to achieve, either body compositional wise or performance wise or fitness level wise? And then, is your training program helping you improve or hit that goal? If the answer is yes, then you keep doing it and you expand and progress with that program. If the answer is no, you go back to the drawing board and you change it. Okay, next question. Not seeing results after 4 weeks on a program and I'm in a calorie deficit and I'm very active. Any advice? So I have a couple of trains of thought on this when it comes to not seeing results on, say, a four-week program or whatever it is that you're doing. So firstly, it comes back to the goal, because if the goal is fat loss happens significantly quicker than building muscle. The process of building muscle takes a very long time for most people. Some people are very genetically inclined to put on size. Those people will get results faster. But for most people, building muscle is quite a long process. Whereas dropping body fat is actually a very fast process in comparison. Like, you can get ridiculous results losing body fat in, say, 6 or 12 weeks, but you're not going to build the equivalent amount of muscle in that same time period. That's going to take closer to 6 or 12 months to put on a considerable amount of size. So not seeing results after 4 weeks, firstly, depends on the goal. I'm going to assume it's body fat based and just kind of getting leaner. And when that's the specific goal, what I would advise here is your tracking method and protocol is so important. One of the biggest problems people get, and this includes people I work with and people with the, for as long as I've been working in fitness, myself included, when you're not tracking your own progress, you're not going to see the results day to day. So I'm assuming when you're on a four-week program that you are in a calorie deficit. You've either tracked that deficit yourself or you're working with a coach who's already designed your nutritional plan and you have a training program based around your specific goals. I'm making that assumption off the front. And when you have that all dialed in, it's very important that you track your progress week on week, because what happens is you won't see that progress day on day. Myself included, this exact same thing has happened to me. One of the reasons when I used to compete and when I would do lots of fitness modeling, photo shoots, etc., I used to have to track my progress with photos, was because you don't see the day-to-day changes. You can only see the changes week to week. And in most cases, it's like a quarter or month-to-month basis. You know, every 4 weeks, every 8 weeks, every 12 weeks, every 6 weeks, etc., whatever kind of program you're following. So one of the ways to do that is photos. My favorite tracking method for body composition is photos. Now, body fat calipers are also very good and they're very accurate, but they're difficult to use and they're difficult to track, and not a lot of people know how to do it correctly. So it's one of the reasons that I don't generally advise it as often as, say, photos. Also, a DEXA scanner is kind of the gold standard, but most people can't get to a sports science premises base or laboratory where they can get a DEXA scan, and a lot of people don't want to spend the money, rightly so, on tracking their body composition goals. You know, it's one of the things that if you're working with, say, an inter-county team or a professional sports team, that they're going to pay for your DEXA scan, by all means then go and do them. But for the average Joe, they're not, probably not worth the money in my opinion. And our average Joe or Jane, depending on your gender. So what I would advise is track your photos. Every single person that comes through my program, my BKF online program and my GA Lean Body program when they're open, I advise them from week one to track their photos every single week. Now, I do this for two reasons. One is from a personal training standpoint and one is for their standpoint. The reason I get them to track the photos every week, and I also get them to do it under the same conditions. So the same day, every single week in the same conditions. So for example, Friday morning, fasted, before they've eaten or drank anything, in the same lighting, same conditioning every single week. That way, there's no change in variable. They haven't eaten one day, they haven't not drank another day, and there's all these change in variables. When you're doing photos or doing any sort of tracking measurement, you want to keep all the variables the same, because that's what gives you feedback on progress. Because if someone's body isn't responding, you're like, okay, we need to make changes somewhere. Or if it's a case that what happens from my experience is people are focused in the negative bias on the part of their body that they're not happy with, and they don't see the progress in the other parts of their body because they're so focused on their stomach, or they're so focused on their lower back fat, or they're so focused on their bingo wings or tricep fat. Even though they're reducing everywhere else, they can only see the negative part of their body they're focusing on. And what happens in that case is, because it's your stubborn area, so if, for example, your abs or your stomach is your quote-unquote stubborn area, so stubborn area basically just means, by nature, it's the last area that your body's going to reduce body fat from. If you're so focused on that area, what you focus on is what expands. That's the part that you see. So even though your arms or shoulders or legs or lower back is all getting reducing in body fat and getting leaner, because your stomach hasn't reduced, because it's your stubborn area, you're thinking your body's not getting any progress. You think you're not getting anywhere. So what photos do is they give you that feedback. And on top of that, as I said, the reason I do it for me is when somebody comes, or if somebody comes to me on week 3 or week 4 of a program, particularly week 6 and into phase 2 on programs, where there's a considerable amount of time when fat loss is the goal, that people's bodies should be responding in a very positive way, I can look at somebody, and I remember I gave this example on my Instagram story earlier today in my Instagram 10 question Q&A. And I remember I had one girl about 3 programs ago on my BKF online program. And she's one of the best before and after pictures I put up in ages. She looks incredible. But I remember she sent me an email on week 6 before we moved on to phase 2. And she was like, I don't think I've got any progress at all. She goes, I've been doing everything. I've been following everything. She goes, I don't think I've done any progress. So I said, okay, send me your week 1 photo and send me your week 6 photo. So she actually sent me all the photos every week. And I got week 1 and week 6. And I went, oh my God. I was like, it literally looked like 2 different people. Her waist had massively reduced. She'd added a little bit of size to her bum and her shoulders. So it made her waist look tiny. And I put them side by side and it's in the back. And she goes, oh, wow. And I was like, yes. I was like, this is your progress. I was like, you can't see it because day to day you don't see the changes. But it's when you compare week 1 to week 6. And she wrote the best testimony. She was so happy. And I was like, because I'd seen it. Because I could tell from check-ins with her every week that she was sticking and adhering to things, that I was even surprised when she messaged on week 6 saying, I've seen no progress. And then when I saw it, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense now. It all came together. So the reason I do that is to put it back on people so it keeps motivation high. Because what happens with motivation, it drops. When you think you're doing all the work and you're not getting the results you want, it's very, very easy for motivation to drop off. That happens for everybody. Like if you're doing something that you think is right and you're putting in time and effort and energy and you're not getting the results, that's very, very frustrating. That's one of the reasons I'm so anti-fad diet, bar diet, juice diet, etc., is because you're putting all your energy and focus into something that is setting you up for failure for the beginning, even though you'll get short-term success with it. And the problem with that is it reinforces that negative pattern towards yourself, going, I can't stick to anything, you know, I'm not able to lose weight, when it's not necessarily you that's the problem, it's your protocols, your strategies, your system, i.e. bar diet, juice diet, etc. You're actually putting your time, energy, effort into the wrong thing, even though you're putting all the time, energy, and effort into it, you know, it's still a ladder against the wrong wall. You know, you can climb as fast and as hard as you can, but if a ladder is up against the wrong wall, you just end up at the wrong destination. So it's very, very important to bring it back. So the reason I do that is those photos are for that accountability for people. It also is a good habit when body composition is your goal to take your photos every week to track how well you're actually progressing. Because in some circumstances where your body's not responding, you have feedback that something needs to change. Your calories are too high, your training intensity is too low, your sleep is poor, and your cortisol or stress is too high. It gives you feedback. So for example, if somebody sends me a photo on week 1, week 4, or week 6, and they're like, right, nothing's changed. I'm like, okay, there's a problem. We need to identify what's going on. Is it that your calories aren't high enough? Are you not adhering to the diet? If you're not adhering to the nutritional plan, why are you not adhering to it? What's wrong with the plan, or why can't we get it sustainable for you? Because that they're all reasonable questions, because what you want in your nutritional plan, particularly in your diet, is something you can adhere to, something you can stick to, something that doesn't feel super restrictive. Because when you do that, it's very, very easy to adhere to it. So it gives you feedback. Your training program is the same. If somebody's not responding, it's like, okay, are you timing your rest periods? Are you lifting in the right rep ranges? Are you working to maximum intensity in your HIIT workouts? If not, you have feedback. The same goes for, right, if you're not sleeping, or you've had a really stressful week, or stressful 6 weeks, or stressful 2 months, or 6 years at work, or a relationship, or, you know, family illness, something along those lines, like, okay, cortisol is through the roof. That's why your body's not responding. And then at least you've got feedback and you can make the changes going forward. So my job as a coach, and anyone that's listening to this is that as a coach, is to either make the changes or to change the expectations. You know, if somebody's sleeping 3 hours a night, even though they're sticking with the nutritional plan and they've got a very stressful job and their mum or dad are sick and their kids are going crazy and they're only 3 or 4 years old and they're running around the place, your job as a coach is to realign the expectation and go, right, you're probably not going to get the same results as somebody else in a 6 week period because your cortisol is through the roof. So let's try and get some stress management techniques in place. Let's try and get your sleep in order. Let's try and do all of these other things that will support you going forward and you realign those expectations. So that's important. So when 4 weeks on a program and you're in a deficit, not very and you're very active, you have to ask yourself, are you tracking that progress week on week? Because then you have actual genuine feedback on if you're improving. If not, it means there's a problem with your program. It means there's a problem with your nutritional plan, or there's a problem with your lifestyle. There's a problem somewhere that you need to change. Or is it that you're focusing too much on the negative aspect of your physique, that you're actually are responding, it's just that you're not responding in the body parts where you want to respond, meaning you just need to be patient. Also, 4 weeks isn't a massive amount of time on a program. My general rule would be you should see good results after 6 weeks, a lot more after 8, and in 12 weeks, you could completely transform your physique, regardless of starting point, in a 12 or 16 week period. But you need to do all the things right and let those compound over time. So hopefully that helps for anybody that is struggling or is frustrated with a lack of progress over whatever time period that you've been on a specific program. Okay, next question. Diet overhaul for weight loss. Is it best to use a PT, nutritionist, or dietitian, or are they all pretty much the same? So my general thought on this, and I'm not sure how popular of a thought this is, and this is my genuine belief, that I would never base the person's qualification on who I work with. I would buy into the person that I think can help me the most. So what I mean by that is, when it comes to weight loss in this specific example, I wouldn't necessarily rate a dietitian higher than a nutritionist or a nutritionist higher than a PT. I would always base it on the person, because generally what happens is qualifications don't determine how good somebody is at what they do. All qualifications do, for the lack of a better term, shows that somebody is very good either in a specific area or they're very good at studying for tests and getting the degrees and the qualifications that they're in. That's not to say there's not amazing dietitians and nutritionists out there. There are 100%. You know, I've had likes of Orla Walsh on the podcast, who's a dietitian. I've had the likes of Rebecca Nolan on the podcast, who's a nutritionist, and they are absolutely incredible. And they are amazing at what they do. They happen to be qualified, but they also happen to be very, very knowledgeable and able to help loads of people because of their expertise. But they're not always the case. Just because somebody is a dietitian or a nutritionist or even a PT doesn't necessarily mean that they're any good. There's a lot of shitty PTs out there. There's a lot of crappy nutritionists, and there's a lot of terrible dietitians. The same way as there's some amazing PTs, some incredible nutritionists, and some incredibly knowledgeable dietitians who can help you get to the end goal. So what I would advise here, as opposed to looking at the qualification, the qualifications can help, and they do give a little bit of social proof, or they give a little bit of authoritative bias, apologies, that that person has a specific knowledge in a realm or area of expertise that they're working within, i.e. a dietitian, nutritionist in nutrition specifically. But when it comes to weight loss, my thought process is always buy into the person. So if there's an online coach, a one-to-one trainer in your gym, a nutritionist that you know, or a dietitian that you've been recommended by or recommended to, I would look into them and do due diligence on the person. Because at the end of the day, as long as the person you're working with has the knowledge to help you get from A to Z, a lot of it comes back on you and what's going to work best for you. So obviously taking extreme ownership and taking responsibility that nothing works and nothing changes until you do the actual work. And it's not the case of, is it the PT, is it the nutritionist, the dietitian? What you don't want to happen, and fuck, do not let this happen, is where you go to a PT, don't lose weight, and go, fuck, no, it wasn't the PT, I need to go to a nutritionist. Then you go to a nutritionist, you don't lose weight, and go, no, fuck, wasn't a nutritionist, I need to go to a dietitian. That's not the solution either. And that's the problem I see with a lot of people. That's not the problem at all. The problem is your adherence to it. As long as you've done your due diligence on working with the right person who you think can get you from A to Z, it's about what you do then, and your adherence to what they say is going to determine your progress. You don't want to always be putting it into the next thing because you don't want to take full responsibility for your own weight loss. That's the problem. You know, when I had Trish's Transformation on the podcast, one of my favorite episodes of all time, she's fucking awesome, you know, losing 100 pounds over the last year, the right way, she was speaking about that. She was like, it didn't matter what trainer I went to, it didn't matter what dietitian I went to, until I took responsibility for it myself, I was never going to be able to lose all that weight. And she's continuously doing that now over time, and puts out amazing content on her Instagram page, Trish's Transformation, inspires fucking loads of people, myself included, where I'm like, you fucking go, girl. Like, putting up her workouts, putting up her personal goals. And that's a case of taking responsibility for your own journey, taking responsibility for your own weight loss. So when it comes to weight loss, I'm going to offer my opinion here. That's kind of my overall thesis and macro opinion on anything you do. You know, I make the same kind of calls in business. I don't generally look at people's qualifications. I look at the results and what they've got with the other people that they've worked with. And my general recommendation and thought process is, when you're looking for weight loss, normally whatever's going to work best for you at the right cost point is going to be key. So my gut tells me a PT, like a good high quality personal trainer, either online or one-to-one, is probably what's going to help best for weight loss, just because a good personal trainer will cover your nutrition and they'll also cover the training aspect and hopefully get you into a lifestyle pattern that can allow you to lose weight over a sustained period of time so that you can keep it off. And nutritionists can also work very well. The only problem with some nutritionists is they won't cover the training element. And to be honest, weight loss is 90% diet anyway, but it is good to complement it with a good training program, a good exercise plan, just because you'll get results faster. And when you get results faster, you tend to stay motivated, which can get you more results. And that's the thing you want to compound over time. When I think of dietitian, I normally think not specifically weight loss. I always think of go to a dietitian when you've got an actual medical problem. You know, if you've got a problem with your gut health, if you've got a problem with IBS, if you've got hyperthyroidism, if you've got something that's very specific that a dietitian can help with, then it tends to make the cost of the dietitian worth the payment. But again, do your due diligence on the people that you know are good. You know, I highly recommend the likes of Orla Walsh. She was on the podcast in January talking about IBS, gut health, and weight loss. Rebecca Nolan was on the podcast a couple of months ago talking about nutrition. She's a nutritionist as well, certified nutritionist. So do your due diligence on who it is that you're going to work with. But for weight loss, it's about who you buy into and then finding what works best for you and then doubling down on that going forward, as opposed to just picking a PT, nutritionist, dietitian based on the specific qualification. Okay, next question. Going on holidays today and dreading holiday bloating, what's the best way to avoid it? So I'm going to cover this one because this is the month in, we're in August, so a lot of people go away this month, and I generally have a kind of a one thought on holiday bloating in general. So I have a lot of people I work with that go away during the month of August. Some go away in September, but particularly around this time, people get holidays. Things are winding down in August in most areas, and people are going away while the weather's good and while the kids are off school, etc. So when it comes to holiday bloating, my thought process on this is always choose your suffering, because there are practical tips and advice I can offer, and I will offer those first. When it comes to being away, my general recommendation for people I'm working with is to walk more and stay active while you're away, to drink loads of water, because when people are away on holiday, the reason they get bloated, the reason they tend to feel very sluggish is normally a combination of being inactive, so lying down all day, eating poor quality food, especially poor quality food than they're used to eating, mixed with dehydration, all of which can cause bloating. But the main thing I would advise when you're going away on holiday is you kind of have to make a choice. When, if you suffer from bloating and if you suffer from digestion, and assuming you haven't fixed that going away, because similar when I had Dr. Lavelle on the podcast last week or earlier this month, he spoke about bloating and fixing your gut health. So bloating is kind of your body's feedback that there's something wrong with either your gut health or something wrong with your food choices, etc. So you need to fix the underlying problem. But when you're going away on holidays, that's not much good, because you're not going to have the 4, 6, 12, 18 weeks in order to fix your gut health, you know, if you're going on holidays today or next week. But what you can do is choose your suffering while you're away. So I've mentioned this in other areas. This is my massive philosophy on choosing your suffering when it comes to things like mental health. So at my Save and Rewire Your Mindset seminar, this is what I talk about when it comes to things like mental health, when it comes to dealing with anxiety, when it comes to dealing with environmental depression. I'm like, choose your fucking suffering. I'm like, you can choose. If particularly anxiety and things that are, if you're left to your default, your mind starts running away with you and you get into an anxious state. You know, I've had panic attacks and anxiety attacks, and I always think back to choose your fucking suffering. You either choose that or you choose to be stronger by doing other things that make you feel uncomfortable. But when it comes to being away on holidays, I think about it with your bloating. I'm like, okay, choose your suffering. You either make a choice, because there's going to be certain foods, and people's mindset when they go on holiday is, you know, I'm on holidays, fuck it. I'm going to eat the food I want. I'm going to drink what I want. And that's cool. By all means, go on holidays and eat what you want and drink what you want. But if you're someone with a sensitive stomach and you know you're going to bloat, then you have to make the choice that if you're going to eat what you want and you're going to drink what you want, then you're going to have to choose the suffering of a bloated stomach. And that's cool. If you can do that over a short period of time and that's the choice you want to make, then go for it. It's also on the other side that you can be very aware that, say, for example, you don't do well with dairy, or say, for example, you don't do well with gluten, or say, for example, you don't do well with high sugar cocktails. You can make the choice before you go on holidays, I'm not going to consume those foods or drinks because I know they bloat my stomach. So you choose your suffering effectively. You either eat the foods and drink the drinks you want and say, fuck it, it's fine, I'm on holidays, and you choose the bloating and that's what you're going to have, or you choose the suffering of not being able to taste those great foods or those drinks that you love, but you don't get a bloated stomach. So you can make choice. You know, my only issue ever is that not being aware of your conscious choice that you're making. You know, it doesn't matter if you have a sensitive stomach and you're going to suffer from bloating while you're away and you haven't fixed your gut health just yet, and you know certain foods are going to bloat your stomach, by all means, eat those foods. Enjoy those foods if that's what you want, and then suffer the bloating out the other side. You know, maybe bring some, as I said, some practical tips with that. Bring some peppermint oil capsules with you. Bring some probiotic, potentially, if you have, especially if you have a fridge where you're going. Bring some extra strength probiotics, and that will all help. They're all actual practical tips you can use while you're away, or you can choose to avoid the worst trigger foods while you're away and then just kind of work within an 80% number of other foods that don't swell your stomach as badly. So that would be my general advice on it. It's a little bit of a different takeaway. I tried to mix a little bit of practical with macro thesis when it comes to holidays, because it's what I apply myself. I have a pretty sensitive stomach for the most part, and if I go on holidays, I normally make the choice that fuck it, I'm gonna have this food for dessert. If it bloats my stomach, cool, I'll deal with it tomorrow. I'll work, get up in the morning, I'll train fasted, I'll drink loads of water, and hopefully the bloat will be gone by midday, and I'll make that choice and I'll choose that suffering. Or else I just won't have the food and go, cool, I actually don't, I want to go out tonight, you know, or I want to feel pretty good when I wake up in the morning, I'm not going to eat that food because I know it's going to bloat my stomach. So you can make the choice, and you can kind of do that on a daily basis. Just take ownership of it, take responsibility for it, and realize that it's your choice when you're going away. So hopefully the mixture of practical tips with kind of macro thesis on holidays helps for anyone that's going away this month. Okay, so next couple of questions are in the realm of mindset. This one kind of overlaps though, so I think it's a nice little segue. How can someone overcome exercise addiction? So just to preface this, I'm not an addiction expert by any means, but I can also massively relate as someone that can become very addicted to exercise and the serotonin release that you get from exercise. So there's a few angles I can come at this one from. As someone that has to guard against this, because I could happily train 3-4 hours a day, the endorphin release I get from exercise is enough to keep me ticking over. I have a very addictive personality by nature. It's literally the reason I stay away from hardcore drugs, because I'm like, I would 100% get hooked on cocaine and you'd never hear from me again. I'm like, I'm going to fucking Thailand and you'll never see me again. And so that's literally the reason why I stay away from hardcore drugs, for self-awareness. You know, I have an addictive personality. I even struggle with caffeine. You know, I've joked in this podcast in the past about my caffeine addiction. And one of the reasons that I don't drink coffee at the weekends is because I could drink it every day, all day, continuously. And that's down to an addictive personality. So some of you will resonate with that, some of you won't. Some of you are more, have more addictive personalities than others. But when it comes to exercise addiction, what I would generally ask, and this is kind of more personal experience, what I found myself when in earlier life, particularly in my early 20s and kind of a little bit into my mid-20s, was exercise works great as a numbing out tool. So some people numb out with alcohol, some people numb out with drugs, some people numb out with mindless television. You know, just numbing out because there's an area of your life that you're not happy with, and this is the thing that's giving you the escape. And when that's the issue, exercise addiction can be a real problem because it's a band-aid over the actual issue. I spoke about it in the mindset section of my first book, The Fitness Mindset, about exercise being amazing, but don't let it be a band-aid. I spoke about it in the worry and anxiety section. Don't let it be a band-aid over the problem, because all that does is it pushes the problem that you are going to have to deal or face with at some stage into the future. And if a problem can be solved today, it's better to solve it today than to let it grow into, you know, a fucking monster dragon in 3 days. You know, slay the dragon while it's small. Don't let the fucker grow into, you know, a giant and come and burn down your whole house. And that philosophy serves me a lot, because you're getting self-aware on the question on why am I consistently addicted to exercise, or why do I feel the need to consistently train? Because if it's a case that there's an area of your life that you're not happy with, i.e. you're single and you want to be in a relationship, i.e. you hate your job and you're really unfulfilled in what you're doing, i.e. you have serious issues with your mental health and this is your form of escapism, because all that gives you is a feedback on that there's another area of your life that needs work on, and you can keep exercising, you can keep going to the gym, you can keep going for runs, you can keep doing this, that, and the other, but that problem over here doesn't go away until you address it. And it's very important that if that's the reason that you're numbing out to exercise, that you go back and fix the root of the problem. So that's one thing to look into. If there's nothing wrong with your life and your life is actually in an amazing state, your relationships are great, you love your job, you're feeling super fulfilled, and you're still getting addicted to exercise, then it's a case of being aware that that chemical lift that you get from exercise, that endorphin release, that serotonin boost, that happy hormone that gets released when you train, you need to figure out other ways to get that. So how I got this, as somebody that has been on both sides of this, I've been on the side where I hated my job, hated my life, was in terrible relationships at some points in my life, and numbed out with exercise. So I've been in that situation as well, and as someone that let those problems grow, and I've spoken on this podcast in the past that if you don't solve a problem when it's small enough to be solved, you deserve to deal with the fuck up that comes and it grows. And that's kind of what happens with that area. You know, if you ignore the bad relationship, if you ignore the job you hate, if you ignore the feeling of being unfulfilled and numb out with exercise, that problem is just going to grow and grow and grow and become a way bigger, to the point that you now have to handle it when it's an actual full-grown problem, as opposed to dealing with it when it was smaller. But I've also been on the other side where life has been great, you know, very fulfilled in what I'm doing, great relationships around me, all of these things, and I can still get addicted to exercise. So what I did was, understanding chemically what's going on, what for me, I had to identify that when I exercise, I feel super clear-headed. So all my anxieties, when I'm left to my default, I've spoken about this in the past, when I'm left to my default and I don't control my thoughts and I don't take full ownership of everything that's coming into my mind and all those anxiety-driven, self-imposed prisons that come, that would be my default. My default is to be very anxiety-driven, very can suffer from panic attacks. That can be my default. One of the reasons my mindset is so strong now, particularly subjectively so strong now, is because it was so weak. And I always think one of the reasons that I can always connect with my overweight clients, and I'm not someone that ever really struggled with fitness as per se. I was always played sport. I was always athletic. But when I see someone that was very overweight and I work with them and then I see how good they are at fitness now, I always think of the mindset equivalent for myself, that the reason my mindset is so strong now is because it was so weak before. You know, I love the Carl Jung quote that your branches or your roots need to go down to hell if your branches need to reach up to heaven. And that's kind of how I feel about mental health. That's kind of how I feel about mindset in general. And what I found when I used to exercise, I used to get that, all that anxiety would just wash over me. They would wave away, and it keeps me grounded. You know, I train 4 to 6 days a week, normally 5 days a week, most weeks, because it keeps me very, very grounded and it keeps me very mentally strong. But the reason that exercise was so addictive for me was because all that chatter, all that chimp mind, all that monkey mind where your brain is just going la 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 and it's just fucking chatter, that just shuts down completely when I work out and when I train, and that stays with me after I train. So when I was able to identify, that's why I was getting addicted to it, because I was getting addicted to the feeling that it gave me. I was like, okay, what other feelings give me this? And for me, I had to experience with it, because there's some that are very supportive, some that are not very supportive. You know, you can go out and hook up with somebody, you're going to get a very similar endorphin release. You can go out and get shit-faced and you're going to get probably a similar endorphin release, particularly if it's mood-enhancing drugs that you're using, but they're not very supportive long-term. So I started experimenting, and one of the reasons that I started taking ice baths and doing the Wim Hof breathing within ice, and I started experience with the sauna, so extreme heat in the sauna, was because of the stress exposure that both of those things gave me without actually having to physically exercise. So I've spoken on this podcast in the past, and I always feel like a little bit misunderstood on Instagram stories when I post up my ice bath or post up my sauna. So I have an ice bath and a sauna in my house, and I feel like people get misaligned with the photo, because the reason, and yeah, there's some scientific studies to suggest that, you know, there's some brain neurotropic factor that happens, brain-derived neurotropic factor, meaning you're going to enhance your learning with exposed heat exposure, i.e. the sauna, or potentially some physical muscle recovery from the ice, but that's not why I do either. The reason I do both is because of the mental benefit that they give me. That stress exposure that I get from working out, that feeling of mental chatter and everything just calming down in my mind, I get the exact same thing from the sauna and I get the exact same thing from cold. When I had to look into it, and it took a while to kind of figure it, and I trialed a lot of different things, I experimented with a lot of different things trying to figure out what worked best for me, and they were the ones I came down to. I'm like, exercise, heat and cold exposure. And when you understand the physiological response of your body when you get put into extreme conditions, a little bit of it came from me when I was in the Sahara last year running 6 back-to-back marathons, and then when I was in the Arctic earlier this year running 230 kilometers, the extreme exposure to heat and the extreme exposure to cold, I actually found both of those by accident, because I was trying to acclimatize my body for the Sahara with the sauna, and I was trying to acclimatize my body for the Arctic with the ice. And as a result, all these mental health, the fight or flight response that you get from that extreme environment or that extreme exposure to heat or cold just shuts down that way of thinking. And when you combine that with a kind of rewiring of your mindset to what you focus on is what expands, you're able to take complete ownership of any thought that goes through your head. And that's the thing that helped me overcome exercise addiction, because if I left it to my own device, I would happily train 3-4 hours every day. I absolutely love training. I love the way it makes me feel, but that's also an addictive behavior. That's not a positive behavior unless you're training for an event or an endurance event, and still that's only an acute training response for a short period of time. You're not going to be training 6 hours every day for the next 10 years. It's just not sustainable for the majority of people. Even professional athletes have downtimes and deloading periods and tapering periods where they're not training at extreme intensity levels. So when it comes to overcoming exercise addiction, I would definitely look into what's causing it. Ask yourself, is it a band-aid over a problem? Are you numbing out from something else in your life? Or ask yourself, are you addicted to the feeling that working out gives you? If that's the case, what other similar things can you do that aren't exercise that are going to give you the same feeling? I got lucky. The sauna does it for me. 15 minutes in the sauna or 5 minutes in an ice bath gives me the same feeling as 2 hours of a workout. So even from a time-saving aspect, I get the same response. It's significantly less time, and I don't actually put the physical strain in my body, meaning that I don't put myself into overtraining. So that can all be beneficial. So if you struggle with exercise addiction and how to overcome it, hopefully some of what I've mentioned here can help you moving forward. Okay, last question. I've 2 jobs, one I hate but pays more, and the other I love but pays less. What should I do? So I wanted to expand on this question, because I actually answered this on one of my Instagram Q&As, and I was doing several videos to this. I'm like, I'm going to put this into a podcast. And the reason I'm going to put it into a podcast is because it's not necessarily this question. I am going to get to this question. But before I do that, when it comes to anybody that hates their job, this is who I'm speaking to now. So if you're doing a job that you hate, I'm speaking to you. I'm also speaking to the people who are in the, yeah, it's okay syndrome. You know, at my Rewire Your Mindset seminar, I speak about, and it's actually in my new book that'll be out before Christmas, the yeah, it's okay syndrome. So, you know, the good being the death of great, or okay being worse than that. And when I can always tell that somebody is underreaching in a relationship, in a business, in a fitness goal, when their response to something is, yeah, it's okay, because it's not enough pain or pleasure to make you move either way. And one of the problems I had when I left my teaching job to move into working what I'm doing now, first it was a personal trainer, then into an online trainer, now into kind of what I'm doing now with online programs with people, working as a speaker, the podcast, writing, etc. One of the things that stopped me making the change for so long was the teaching job I was in when I actually finally left teaching was a job I quite liked. It was okay. And it wasn't enough that I hated it, because when you hate something, you hate the person you're with in the relationship, you hate the job that you're doing, you hate something, that's a really strong response to something that's going to make you make a change. You know, love and hate are very two powerful emotions that can pull or push you in different directions. Yeah, it's okay, it's fucking smack bang in the middle, meaning you don't make any change. You know, that's generally the advice I offer at my seminars is, if this was the only relationship you got this year, if this is the only relationship you get for the rest of your life, if this is the only job you get for the rest of your life, if this is the only thing that you get to do for the rest of your life, would you be happy? And you can tell a lot by the response on that, because if the relationship you're in, you're like, if this is the only one I think I'm going to get, I don't actually think I'd be happy with this person long term. You're like, okay, you got feedback there that you need to address. If you're doing a job that you're like, nah, yeah, it's okay. You know, I don't want to be doing it forever, but it's okay for now. You've got feedback that you need to start getting your ladder up against the right wall elsewhere in your business career. So when it comes to hating a job, I'm actually way more for that than somebody that is in a, yeah, it's okay scenario, because that's very difficult to make the change. So when it comes to hating your job, this one's, to expand on this particular question, when you're working two jobs, one you hate that pays more and the other that you love but pays less, the first question that comes to mind straight away is there a cap on the one that you get paid less on? So one of the reasons, for those of you unfamiliar with my backstory, for those of you who are familiar, I'll just give a refresher. I worked as a primary school teacher for 4 years, and for two of those years, I used to work as a fitness personal trainer at nighttime. And I did those two jobs for 2 years. And one wasn't a job I hated, but teaching was very much a job, whereas personal training and working in fitness was something I absolutely loved to do. And I actually left my full-time teaching job and went personal training full-time when I was making more money as a personal trainer than I was as a teacher. That's advice I offer lots of people that come to, say, my business seminars or that I work with directly in business. It's like, work your two jobs, get your side hustle up to the point where it's earning more than your full-time job, and then make the jump, then make the switch. And the reason I ask about a cap is because in my circumstance, the first realization that I wanted to work in fitness, and the first realization that I realized that what I was doing wasn't going to work for me long term, was I asked myself a very, very simple question. I asked, if I was working as a teacher for $100,000 a year, would I prefer to be working as a teacher for $100,000 a year, which you wouldn't get as a teacher, but it was a hypothetical thought experiment. I question that and put that parallel to that with, would I rather earn $20,000 a year as a personal trainer? And my answer straight away was, I'd rather earn $20,000 a year as a personal trainer, working in a gym as a fitness, working in fitness. And that was what made me make the mindset shift that, right, I need to start putting my ladder against the right wall and start moving into an area of life that I feel like I would do this work for free. So that I'm a little bit biased when people talk about doing a job they love. And I'm biased in the sense that because I've been in the experiences where I've hated jobs. I hated my fucking first teaching job. I used to also clean dishes in a hotel, and I fucking hated that. I also tended bar in a nightclub, and I can think of nothing worse. Like, I would never, ever, ever go back to that job. And I've had the contrast point of doing jobs that I absolutely hated. And that's a really beneficial thing. I spoke about in a podcast interview with the School of Calisthenics. I was on the School of Calisthenics podcast, and they asked me about, do you love your job so much because you just found what you were looking for, or do you love your job so much because you didn't like other jobs? And I was like, it's 100% because I hated other jobs. It's failure is feedback. One of the reasons that, again, at my seminars, in the books, on the podcast, I speak about using failure as feedback, is that it's a contrast point, and it gives you, you're way fucking better to have shitty contrast points, because when you have positive contrast points, it makes it feel more worthwhile. So every fucking terrible relationship you've had, every time you've been codependent or cheated on, you've got direct contrast point on a relationship that does work, and you can be way more grateful for that positive relationship because you've had the shitty ones in the past. You're using failure as feedback. Every job that you've hated up to this point, every time you went into the office and somebody fucking yelled at you and you wanted to like crawl under the fucking desk or punch them in the face, you have a contrast point when you're doing something you love that you never want to go back to a job that you hated. Those contrast points make you stronger. They make you better. They give you feedback on what you never want to go back to. And they give you a point that when times get tough in the thing that you do love, in the relationship with the person that is right, in the job of the job that you should be doing, in the career, in the area that you should be in, you never want to go back because you're like, well, this is what it was like when I was working there, and I never fucking want to go back to that. Use those contrast points going forward. So when it comes to this job, and the reason that I tell the story of myself as a personal trainer was there was no cap. One of the things I love about being an entrepreneur and running my own business is the harder you work, the more money you make. The more people you help, the more revenue you generate. That's literally the way entrepreneurship works. So when it comes to a second job, you kind of have two options. If you hate one job but pays more and you love the other, if there's no cap I personally would put my time, energy, and focus into the job that I love, knowing that when you grow that, you're going to earn significantly more than in the job that you currently hate right now. As someone that's lived that, I can tell you firsthand that that can be done with the right action steps, working with the right people, and getting your message and business model correct from the beginning. That's number one. If there is a cap on your job, the other option is that you do something you love and you massively reduce your spending and you massively reduce your lifestyle on whatever outgoings that you have. I personally connect so highly with some of my friends who are on low paying jobs, but love what they do and have a perfect balance, than some of my friends who are on very high paying jobs in the 6 and 7 figures who fucking hate what they do. And the reason for that is life's too fucking short to do a job you hate. Particularly, like, when you wake up, when you think about the amount of hours you're putting into a job, it's a massive proportion of your day. It's, you know, 8 hours a fucking day. You know, it's a fourth of your day every single fucking day. A third, fourth of your day every day if you take out sleeping. That's a huge chunk of your time. And if you hate what you're doing, that's going to compound over time and you're going to be miserable. And as a result, you end up, in a lot of cases, taking that out on the people closest to you. You know, it's a one of the pushbacks I get on this when I, and I, as I said, you can hear my animation, my voice, as someone that's lived this. And one of the pushbacks I get on this is someone that has kids, mortgage, bills, etc. I'm not saying that you have to quit your job tomorrow, but what I am saying is if you fucking hate your job and you're not putting action steps in place to change it or get your ladder against the right wall in some other area, in another job or your own business or something else, then nothing is going to change. Nothing changes if you don't change anything. And the time scale may change based on your amount of commitments right now. So if you have 10 kids and a mortgage and bills to pay, you're probably not going to leave your job tomorrow. But you have to ask yourself the question, right, I want another job. How do I deserve to get a job that I love? And start asking that question. If it's a case you're like, okay, I don't have the experience, then you need to go get the experience in a job that you would love, you know, or find a way to make yourself more hireable. If it's a case that you want to start your own business, how can you deserve to get your own business off the ground and get that up and running so you help more people? You need to find a product or service that's able to go out there and help more people, and you need to market it, advertise it, and work with the right people and actually impact people's lives. If you can do that in a positive way, for the most part, you'll have a business that works and you've now deserved to have a business that's successful. You're asking the wrong question. How, if you want to get what you want, you have to deserve what you want. That puts ownership back on you. And I can't stress it enough. If you fucking hate what you do every single day, if you're in a low risk position, you're young, you have no bills, you've no kids, you've no dependents, then you could probably make that jump pretty easily. Somebody that is older with a few kids and bills and mortgages to pay, then true, you're not going to be able to make that jump tomorrow, but maybe in 6 months you can, maybe in 12 months you can, maybe in 8 months you can. But you have to start taking action steps that feed into that. As long as you know the end goal, that there's something else out there that you want to do, my advice is to go and fucking do it. Like, life is too short to be around fucking dickheads, to be doing jobs that you hate, or in a relationship with somebody that you dislike. Like, it's that fucking simple. Like, that's it. There's no other message that I can give. I'm like, when you stop living like you're going to live for fucking ever and you realize that at some stage, your life's going to end. You know, one of my favorite books, and not necessarily because the book I didn't get as much from, but I love the message, is The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying. And if you can go to your deathbed, I've spoken about my 97-year rule on the podcast before. Ask yourself, what would your 97-year-old regret more? If you fucking hate a job, I guarantee you on your 97-year-old deathbed, you're going to be like, I wish I fucking changed jobs. That goes for absolutely everything in your life. If you're not happy where you are, you need to change something. If you're not happy where you are, you can move. You're not a fucking tree. So what I would advise in this scenario, and in any scenario where you're unhappy with something in your life, take back full control of it. Take ownership of it completely, because when you own it, you can control it. And when you control it, you can change it. All you have to go out then is find, what is the next action step? What do I need to do? Who do I need to work with? How do I need to improve? How do I need to get better in order to get what I want? Really is as simple as that. If you're going through life and you hate something, you need to fucking change it. Nobody's coming to save you. There's no fucking superhero coming to swoosh in and save you. There's no person going to offer you that dream job. There's no person going to offer you that dream person. There's no person going to offer you all these things on a silver platter. It doesn't fucking work like that. Nobody is coming to save you. But what can happen is if you take full ownership of it, you can control it and you can change it. Start asking better questions. To get what you want, you have to deserve what you want. If you ask that question repeatedly, in whatever it is that you want to achieve in your life, in your business, in your personal life, in your romantic life, fitness life, whatever. To get what you want, you have to deserve what you want. You need to make new action steps. Keep the end goal in mind and then take daily action steps that help you get towards that end goal. It's as simple as that. If you have two jobs, one that you hate that pays more, the other that you love that pays less, what you should do. For me, it's a no-brainer every single day of the week. I think life is too short to be doing something you hate. Life is too short to be around negative people. Life is too short to be in an unfulfilling job. Life is too short to have people telling you you can't do things. Life is too short for you to be constantly making decisions based on the opinions of other people. Life is too fucking short for all of that. Make the decision, make the change, own it, control it, change it. Okay, so that's everything from today's podcast. Got a bit heated at the end. I didn't expect that one. I never know sometimes what trigger questions are going to fucking trigger me and set me off. So that was one of them. So hopefully that helped. Yeah, I'm going to listen back to that one because I hope I made sense on that. Because I never know. When I go off on rants, I just never know. I'm like, fuck, did I even make sense on that? So hopefully it kind of just comes straight from your heart, head, whatever you want to call it. It goes straight out of the podcast. So hopefully that helped. So that is everything from today's episode. Hopefully you enjoyed. If you did, one of the things I will ask, a massive ask for me, is if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And tag me in your Instagram story, but particularly leave a review because I'm checking out all those reviews now on Spotify, Stitcher, and iTunes. So if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review or just give it a rating even, and I'll love you forever. So without further ado, I'll catch you all next week.